The Sunday Grill with Orla Rapple on Beat 102-103.
My first guest on the grill this morning comes from the Czech Republic via Tremor in County Waterford. 20-year-old Joshua Curran was born in Prague, where his mum is from. She's from the Czech Republic, but he spent his summers on the beach in Tremor at his granny's. But Josh isn't on the show this morning to talk about those memories. No, Josh is here because he is the first Irishman to write a Eurovision track for Armenia. It's called Survivor. We'll play it in a bit, but first Josh joins me this morning. You're very welcome, and welcome back to the southeast and to County Waterford. What would be the land of your summer memories, is it?
It is. Hello, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be joining this call.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, and it's great to talk to someone who has this massive deal of 180 million people will be watching and listening to your song in just a few weeks' time, thanks to the Eurovision, and that you come via Tremor in County Waterford. Tell us about that. What are your connections to Tremor?
That's crazy, first of all. Second of all, as you said, my dad is Irish. My granny, she lives in Tremor. So ever since I was a kid, we flew there every summer. We spent our summers there with my cousins, with my siblings. Like, I've got very fond memories of Tremor. It's just a very nice place to be at when you're a kid.
So what are your favourite bits about Tremor? What do you remember the best?
What I remember the best as a kid was definitely the amusement park in Tremor.
Yes.
especially the haunted house and the water slide.
Oh, the water slide is very popular.
Yeah. I love that. I've got so many photos of when I'm actually riding that ride. But yeah, I've got very fond memories of the amusement park, and then of course the beach. Me and my dad and my younger brother, we used to surf there every summer. That's where I picked up the hobby of surfing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So lots of links and lots of memories here in the southeast. But you're a musician, or you're a multi-instrumentalist and a songwriter as well. And your song is going to be the song for Armenia in the Eurovision. Tell us about this. Like, the Eurovision, is it something that you remember from when you were little? Like, it used to be so big in Ireland when we were so great at it and won it so many times. But I suppose when you were younger, we weren't really in our heyday, were we?
From what I remember, the first time I saw Eurovision was probably back in 2014 when I was 9 years old. From what I do remember the most is 2016 when a local Czech guy nearly won the Eurovision. I think he was fifth. So that's like what I really remember. Also, I'm a big fan of Father Ted, so the Eurovision episode was always my favourite.
Good stuff. So how did this start? How did you end up writing for Armenia?
Well, it was a pretty cool coincidence, because my agent, she's from Armenia, and so is Park and his manager. So she got in touch with Park's manager. We had a huge group call back in January. To be fair, at the start of the session, I was like, I didn't take it much seriously. I was like, all right, we're going to try to write a song, but it's never going to get to Eurovision. So it was a huge shocker when it won the Armenian, let's say, little Eurovision, smaller one. Because like in Armenia, you've got this competition, and whoever wins the competition goes to represent Armenia.
Yeah, that's like Ireland as well.
It is in Ireland too. So it was a huge shocker. But an incredible experience, and I can't wait to see it live.
And you're saying Parg there, that's the singer. And tell us a bit about him. He's quite the following on social media and everything.
He does. He looks really intimidating, but he's really chill. His English is not the best.
Okay.
But he tries a lot. So I throughout the whole process, I was mostly communicating with his manager.
Okay.
He's really, really sweet, really nice, really friendly. He's just a really nice guy.
Will we have a listen to a bit of Survivor? I find it weird to hear you say that his English isn't great. Now, he does pronounce some words a little bit strangely, but this is an English track. So will we have a listen to some of Survivor, and then we'll have a chat about it.
I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor.
There you go. That is Survivor, written by Joshua Curran. He's got a bit of an Irish twang there, doesn't he, Joshua? The way he says Survivor.
Yeah, I thought that too.
And there's a little bit of Irish influence, I think, there. What do you think?
It might be, yeah. Because I'm a huge fan of Irish music. I love Fontaine's DC. I love Inhaler, obviously the Pogues. So yeah, I do listen to a lot of Irish artists and bands, and so it might be that there are some Irish influences in my stuff.
Good
yeah,
stuff.
For sure.
And tell me, Armenia did okay, didn't they, last year in the Eurovision? They've got through the semi-finals, I think, three times, from the semi-finals to the finals. Do they have to do the semi-finals again this year then, or are they through to the finals?
They have to do the semi-finals.
They have to do the semi-finals.
It is quite a tough one. To be fair.
And yeah. do you know if they're day one or day two now, or?
They're the second day.
They're the second day. Okay, yeah. So fingers crossed for that. And have you heard our Irish entry?
I did.
And what do you think of that?
I think it's very, like, very new, very original.
Yeah, it is. It's very different. Yeah.
It's very different.
Yeah.
But I think it's cool. I think it's fun. It's a Eurovision track. It does its job. So, yeah, I just wish it the best.
Good stuff. That's the way to be. Now, have you been getting much traction? Because you are the Eurovision entry. You've written the Eurovision entry for Armenia. I suppose after the Eurovision is where it'll all snowball for you. But so far, have people really sat up and noticed that you are the person who's written the song for Armenia?
Yeah, it did get some attraction for sure. I did get a lot of messages from producers and from songwriters. So it's been pretty cool so far. And I can't wait to network once I'm there. I think that's going to be the proper deal for me, but so far so good. Yeah, I'm really happy with the love that the song is getting and with the attraction that it's getting.
Excellent. You're only 20, so what would be the dream? What would you like to see yourself doing? Could you even see yourself on the Eurovision stage singing?
Yeah, that's true. I just turned 20 last month, but it is a dream. It is a dream to once be a performer in the near future at Eurovision, but it wouldn't be such a big deal if I wasn't gonna do it, because I love music in general, and I love doing music on my own, doing my solo stuff. But for sure, it is on my bucket list to try it and do my best to get to Eurovision.
Okay. And represent the Czech Republic or represent Ireland, or where would you go with that?
Both. I would try both, really.
Okay. Brilliant.
Yeah.
And you're only 20, and you said earlier that you already have an agent, so things are going well.
They are doing pretty well. Yeah, I'm lucky. Yeah, it is doing pretty well, but I'm working hard. I'm wanting more. So I'm just at the start, really.
Yeah, of course. And is it more about writing you're doing at the moment, but are you performing and trying to release your own music as well?
Everything, really. I'm spending a lot of time in the studio. When I'm not in the studio, then I'm performing. We're having band rehearsals. I'm also studying at the moment. So there's a lot of stuff going on. I'm really busy over the week. I'm just doing a lot of stuff for me too. I'm releasing new music very soon. It's everywhere on Spotify if you want to check it out. It's really exciting. Everything is really exciting at the moment.
Great stuff. Well, it's a great start to 2025, being the person who wrote the song for the Armenian entry the Eurovision. And as we said, 180 million. We were only talking recently about a show on Netflix called Adolescence, having 66 million viewers. And it's the most viewers Netflix has ever had. You can multiply that by three. For people watching the Eurovision in May, Joshua, that's kind of hard to fathom that amount of people will be watching a song that you wrote.
I actually never realized until you just said it now.
Yeah,
and I think that's actually really crazy.
Yes.
I never thought about it until just now.
Absolutely,
that's really
huge.
Crazy.
Yeah, well, the first Eurovision Song Contest semi-final is going to be on RTE on Tuesday, the 13th, and then the second one is on Thursday, the 15th of May, and then the big grand finale. And really, fingers crossed that Armenia gets into that grand finale with your song, Joshua, is on Saturday on the 13th of May. So best of luck with that. You know what? I'm going to head to Dooley's in Tremor and have a bag of chips in your honour, Joshua.
Thank you so much.
Listen, if people want to check you out on Spotify, how will they find you?
Under my name, Joshua Kern.
Okay, good stuff. And that's what you are on Instagram and social media as well. Joshua,
everywhere.
Thank you so much for talking to me this morning.
Thank you so much. Have a nice day.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rappel on Beat 102-103.
Well, it's time to talk to one half of a Carlo couple living it up in Paris at the moment. Jim and Bernadette Murphy are from Murphy's Craft Butchers in Tullow in County Carlo. And they were part, or are part, of a six-person team representing Ireland at the World Butchers Olympics in Paris. They've already had a win. And let's find out more from Jim. You're very welcome, Jim. Lai, we're talking to you from Euro Disney,
Paris.
Is that right?
Yeah,
Disneyland Paris.
Yep. We're in Disneyland Paris here. We're calming down after the madness of the Butcher Olympics, as we call it.
So from one extreme to another, to head to all those rides at Euro Disney Paris, let's talk about the Butcher Olympics, though. This isn't your first rodeo, is it?
No, we've been training since around 2018. We went to Sacramento in September 2022, where we won the best pork sausage in the world.
Oh, nice.
And we've been training for Paris once it was announced for about the last 2 years, every second Sunday. The 16 members, and we have two apprentices as well. So we've been training very hard. We give up, they give up their time, you know, all the, there's no financial gain. All the butchers give up their time and they come to the shop in Tullow. We have good facilities there and we do all the training in the shop in Tullow. And there's a lot of work. A lot of preparations. We have the ACBI, the Associated Craft Butchers of Ireland.
Okay.
They're our kind of main backers behind us, and we get great help from Jack, Brendan, Dave. They're all involved in the
Brilliant
team as
stuff.
Well.
Great. And tell me, the best sausage in the world of 2022, that's still available at your butchers, is that right?
Oh yeah, yeah. We sit, like, you know, we try to bring the stuff back to the shops, like, you know, it's all. We kept the sausage recipe going. It was our recipe, so we just kept the sausage recipe going. So, you know, we were trying to get out in the market around the country and that through Musgraves and things like that. Look, it's not easy to get to that stage.
Of course.
But we have it available in the shop and we've very good brand and very good packaging done. So
brilliant.
It's great.
And tell us about your win this time round in Paris.
Yeah, so you, in Paris, you see, for you get, there's seven different categories. So if you win a category, you get an extra 10 points. So you have the best beef, best pork, best sausage, best chicken. So if you, the more you can win, the more chance you have of winning the overall competition. So I do put a lot of effort into trying to win the best product. So you do a lot of work with flavors and seasons and marinades to try win those products. You know, so
you won in the best chicken category, is that right?
Yeah, so this one I created was called Chicken Italiano. So it was pistachio nuts, lemon and lime zest, mixed with a lovely lemon kind of breadcrumb. We have Parmesan cheese, we have Parma ham, and we've sun-dried tomatoes, and we have a lovely marinade on it. And that, and just piped on the top with cream cheese and fresh lemon and cherry tomato. So it sounds really good, but it is actually a beautiful product.
Lovely. And pistachio's massive at the moment, thanks to the Dubai chocolate.
And yeah, the Dubai.
And you sell that in your butchers as well then, do you?
When I get back home on Monday, I think Sunday I'm going to have to make lots of chicken Italianos from Monday morning. The brother said, there's people already looking for this chicken Italiano.
I'd say so. And tell me, you've been in the business of butchering, your family has. You're the fifth generation of master butchers. You're based on Church Street in Tullow, if people are looking for you, and you've been there since 1909. Your family has. Butchering has changed a lot in 126 years, hasn't it? I think
when
people go to the butchers now, they're looking for a very specialised product, aren't they?
Yeah, like young people have different tastes. Like, you know, it was traditionally beef and lamb and kind of the bacon and cabbage when I started with my father and grandfather in 1988. And kind of, I've seen the progression of food trends over the years. And now young people want, you know, they want something quick, but they want something tasty. So, you know, they don't want to be at home cooking stew like our grannies and our mothers did for three hours. They want to bang it in an air fryer or put in the oven. They want it cooked in 30 minutes. They want the sides to go with it. And a lot of this stuff, like the chicken Italiano, it's all cooked quickly, but has great flavor and great taste.
Good stuff. And do you find that they're looking for...
Young people don't get the taste. Yeah.
And are they looking for things like protein packs and stuff like that? That seems to be buzzwords these days.
Yeah, look, I think it was more of a buzz maybe a couple of years ago. Mm. I think people now in general want things a little bit healthier anyway. So It's great. But it has changed. Food trends, you have to keep up to date with it. You know?
Yeah, of course. And what about, you know, meat-wise? I know people try to veer away sometimes from red meat or try to have it less than we would have had maybe when we were kids. Do you find that in the butchers?
No. I would always say to people, you know, if you're cooking a steak, you know, it's all you need is a tiny little bit of oil. You don't need to plaster the stuff with oil, because meat, if it has a nice bit of marbling, will create its own juices to cook. And you should always fry sausages, fry a steak. I'm talking about a tiny bit of olive oil or the rapeseed oil. You don't need to plaster it. And, you know, it's as healthy a product as you'll get. You're not using anything bad by doing that, you know.
And do you have a favourite product in there then, Jim? Is there something that you love to eat again and again from your butchers?
Oh, I love, for the kids and for me, I still love spaghetti bolognese.
Oh, yeah.
It's a simple one, but the kids, they'd eat it, and I have a chicken fillet wraps with bacon and our own homemade stuffing. Never, those two meals, I have to have them stable every week with the kids.
Yum, every that sounds week. Amazing. Good stuff. Well, look, congratulations, best chicken product. And as Jim said, the chicken Italiano is going to be prepped tonight when he gets back from France, and hopefully available tomorrow, Monday. Is that right, Jim?
Yeah, we'll be back on Monday morning. We'll have chicken Italia.
Wow, that's a quick turnaround.
Yeah,
fair play to you. Chicken is huge these days. That seems to be what I eat most days.
Chicken has gone probably over. You know, it's taken over on beef and lamb in Ireland in butcher shops and in most shops. But in butcher shops, lads would have seen their sales of beef and lamb reduce and chicken sales gone up. So it's just, you have to evolve.
You do have to evolve. And I'm sure it's very different to when your generations ago, your great-great-grandfather was in the butchers in Tullow. It's the same shop, but a different vibe, is it?
Same shop, different vibe. But we still have our own EU licensed abattoir. So we still kill from the, you know, the premises. We still do cattle and sheep there. So we buy local, low food miles, you know. So we are the real farm.
And people love that, don't they? They love that craft butchers.
Love it. You know, they love to hear that nowadays as well. It's good for the environment. You know, we mm-hmm. have lads, farmers, 1 minute away who bring their stock to us. Like, so you're supporting the farmer as well, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I'll let you get back to Disneyland Paris. What ride are you going to go on now, Jim?
Oh, God, I don't know. The first one wasn't a great one. Tomorrow in the House of Horrors or something. That was dodgy after.
Oh, I have seen that. I have been the person waiting for my family to come off that ride. You wouldn't get me near it. So fair play to you for doing that. I think
it's a way to Avengers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right beside it. And it's a small world after all. In the other park is a nice easy one for the afternoon.
That one for a handy one with the kids.
Exactly. Well, enjoy it and congratulations. Best chicken product for your chicken Italiano at the Butchers Olympics in Paris in France. And of course, that is Jim from Murphy's Craft Butchers, and they're based in Tullow in County Carlow, and you'll find them on Church Street there if you're looking for a craft butchers. Jim, enjoy the celebrations and thanks for talking to me this morning.
Thank you. I'll talk to you, bye.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rappel on Beat 102-103.
It's a Sunday morning, you're listening to Beat, and this is the Sunday Grill, and the Waterford Festival of Food returns this month from April 25th to the 27th. Of course, always celebrating Ireland's rich food culture. There's nearly 100 events on offer, and it showcases the best of Waterford's rich food heritage. The main hub is in Dungarvan as usual, but there's also events taking place in parts of West Waterford like Lismore, Ardmore, Ballyduff. The list goes on. You can head over to waterfordfestivaloffood.com to get more details. Well, as well as the food stalls and the events, there's also a chance to see and hear the stories behind the bite, and that's thanks to an exhibition of the same name. Jane Gormley from Crackley Stories has curated the stories, and she joins me to tell me more about that. You're very welcome, Jane.
Oh, thank you, Orla. Lovely to be here.
This is an interesting exhibition. You need to explain this because for the most part, it's a traditional photography exhibition with a little bit more bite, pardon the pun.
That's a good line.
Thanks.
So last year, visitors to the festival last year may remember a very beautiful photography exhibition. The photos were taken by Jolene Cronin, and I think there were 40 photographs in all, and they exhibited kind of portrait photographs of a lot of the local food contributors or producers and farmers and so on. And so this is an extension of that. And this year, my contribution has been that we've been working with all of the the subjects, if you like, of those portraits and those people, and talking to them about their food experiences and their observations and, you know, the just the story behind what they do and what's happening in the photograph. And that's the new edition. Yeah.
And what have you done? Have you recorded it or videoed it? What have you done?
So I've spoken to, so there's about 40 people, and what we've done is over the last couple of months, we've been interviewing them, and we've been bringing those, trying to bring those stories down to really bite-sized kind of 250 word snippets. Yeah, it's hard to write a short story actually. So the 250 word snippets just means that we get a little window into each one of those people's experiences and what it's like being kind of like being a food producer, yeah. I suppose, in the region, and what they have to say about it.
And you're not from Waterford, but did you take home, like, there's such a huge amount of food producers in Waterford.
I know.
Did you find that?
Yeah, I mean, look, the festival, I suppose, showcases that so well. And it's, you know, everyone keeps telling me about the microclimate in Dungarvan as well, which I've witnessed at nearly all the festivals so far. It's always like peak summer. And actually, a long time ago, I used to live in Lismore. I had a good base knowledge of some of the things that are happening in the area. But it's really incredible when you read some of these stories, what people have been working on.
Yeah, it's just so crazy to see from, and a lot of them from West Waterford, where the Festival of Food will be, of course. So it's a series of black and white portraits, is that right?
Yeah, the photographs are very beautiful. They're all photographed in black and white, and then our stories will accompany them. So when you're going through the exhibition, you'll be able to, you know, enjoy the photograph and then read the short story beside it as well.
Lovely stuff. And 250 words, hard to do. I did journalism in college, and I always found that very hard to get down to 250 words. So fair play to you. Well, we talk about some of these food heroes. Like, for example, we have a person from France who's been living here for 24 years. I'm not going to attempt her name, so you can go for that. And she is from Cumara Mountain Farm.
That's Clotilde is most likely well known in the area. She has a really amazing story. Essentially, she's a producer, so they have herself and her husband run Cumara Mountain Farm. She's a very well known product in her free range chickens, but they also produce like vegetables and salad leaves and seasonal veg kind of all year round. And her story is fabulous in that, you know, not only the work that they've done, there's a lovely motif in her story in that, rather than put up fencing to protect her chickens, so her chickens are all free range out in feet, like absolute free range.
Free range.
You know, they're in paddocks. And so then very quickly, how to protect these chickens became something that her and her husband were trying to work out. And there's always options of fencing and wires and so on, but they decided to go down a more traditional route, which they thought would be much more fun. And they engaged with they got a protection dog. So it's a really specific breed that would have been used. Yeah, it's lovely. And he photographs beautifully also. but that's part of, you know, maybe it's something that people will really remember from Clotilde's work.
And is that a very big dog or?
It's like a mountain dog kind of, but he's really specially trained. So he spends all of his time with his chickens and protects them and minds them. Because look, obviously there are complexities to keeping chickens out in the field and out in the beautiful Waterford countryside. There's lots of foxes and mink and other things that would have their eye on Clotilde's chickens. So it's a really traditional practice. And I think that my understanding is that these bears, like over, you know, centuries would have protected sheep. These dogs would have protected sheep from the bears. But they've adapted over time and
Brilliant
now
stuff.
They're protecting chickens and waterbirds, which is cool. Yeah.
So she's featured in the photos, as is the dog. So that's a lovely story that will be part of the exhibition. And then we have to talk about a mainstay of Dungarvan. If you've ever been to Dungarvan in West Waterford, you will know of the Shamrock. They are, in my life, they're very famous for their biscuit cake, their chocolate biscuit cake. But they've just been there, like started in 1981. So this is a great story to get.
Oh, it's lovely, isn't it? Yeah, I spoke to John, who is one of the family members, and the O'Riordans, John O'Riordan. And what really struck me was that, you know, there's so much that the Shamrock does. And obviously this is a food festival and we talked a lot about the efforts that they go to from what comes out of their kitchens. But much more than that, John spoke so pointedly about his family and the multi-generational kind of efforts and energy and work that has gone into what really is an institution, and, you know, people having grown up there and the community of people working there, the community of people coming and enjoying it, and the memories and the, I suppose, just the feeling of it. And, you know, just the way he worded it, I thought was so lovely. It turned out to be a really beautiful story.
And it's lovely to have, you know, the real staples of Dungarvan, because, you know, even where I'm from in County Wexford, there's always those shops and those premises that are just part of the fabric of a town. And then there's so many new businesses that come in. So it's lovely to have all those different types of businesses and especially food producers as well.
Yeah, I know. And you know, there was, you know, some threads that came out from the story, because I had a lovely kind of vantage point of having got to speak to everybody, but they couldn't hear one another being interviewed. But constantly they reference each other and the support that, you know, a newcomer maybe to the region or somebody with a new idea, just the positivity in the area and how much each other's presence means to everybody. You know, it builds confidence, of course.
Everybody helps
also
each other.
Yeah.
Good stuff. And it's great to see he went off to the US and before joining the kitchen. So he did lots of stuff before he came back and was part of the family business at the Shamrock in Dungarvan. Listen, a lovely addition. It was, as you said, the exhibition of photos were there last year. But this year you get to hear the stories behind the bite as well. And that's what the exhibition is called. It's April 25th to the 27th. And Jane Gormley is the lady behind the stories. She's from Crackley. And then the photography is from Jolene Cronin. And they have some gorgeous black and white photos there. If you want to check out more details, it's waterfordfestivalofffood.com, the 25th to the 27th of April. But that exhibition runs in Curran's Hardware in Dungarvan in County Waterford. Jane, thanks a million for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much, Orla.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rappel on Beat 102-103.
It's a Sunday morning. You're listening to the Sunday Grill here on Beat, and big news from the Hook in County Wexford this week when it was announced that the Loftus Hall is up for sale again. The so-called most haunted house in Ireland got a 2 million overhaul in the last few years, and a luxury hotel was expected, but those plans have been abandoned. And the three-story mansion that overlooks the Hook Peninsula and has been a convent, it's been the place of movies, it's on the market again. Well, Paul Ferrick is from Hook Tourism and he joins us on the Sunday Grill this morning to tell us more about Loftus Hall and its history, because it's not just about a card game and the devil, etc., etc. It's got lots of history, doesn't it, Paul?
Certainly does. Yes, it dates back to the late 12th and early 13th century originally. Yeah, when there's been a building there from Raymond the Gross. He was the general that came with Strongbow, Richard de Clare, here in 1165.
Okay.
Landed here at the beach on Hook Peninsula in Bag and Bun and set up his reign of terror, you could call it, for the first 20 years or so, until Richard de Clare honed him in and William Marshall took over. Okay. But he granted him the lands of the monastery of Saint Duvon.
Okay. And is that where Loftus Hall is now?
That is where Loftus Hall is now, in the monastery lands. And Duvon is the saint, or the man who started a monastery way long before that, in the 497 or so AD. But Duvon gave his name to Hook, because when Duvon is translated in the Anglo-French that the Normans spoke, it's translated as Hook, or Shape of Hook.
Oh, okay. All right, I did not know that. Okay.
There we are. So St. Duvon gave us our name.
So are you saying that there's been three structures there, including Loftus Hall as we now know it now?
Loftus Hall as we know it is a relatively new structure, in that it's the mid-19th century, Victorian era, the manor house of the Redmond family. But prior to that, there was the original Loftus Hall, which was built in the 16th or the 17th century after the Cromwellian attack and his captain Loftus. And then before that, there was the Norman manor house.
Okay, so built there's been by, three structures. Okay.
Oh, at least, yes. Yeah.
And tell me this, Paul, which one of those structures, where did this card game and the devil coming through the roof, that story that we all know?
That's the Victorians. And it's typical of the Victorians as well. It's, you know, okay, the I hate to spoil
it's everywhere,
a good story
isn't
with
it?
The facts.
Yeah, because I went
it is
to
everywhere,
a,
yeah.
I went to do some sort of filming, if I remember rightly, in another big house up past Dublin, and they suddenly were telling that story, and I was like, that is not your story to tell.
The Hellfire Club has exactly the same story.
And I think it was another big old Victorian house that had that story. And I was like, this is the Loftus House story. What's going on here? So it's just a, what would you call it, a piece of folklore?
It is, but it's a convenient piece of folklore and was used considerably at the time to cover up the shame of having a teenager pregnant in your family.
Oh, okay.
And in this case, it was young Annie Tottenham.
Okay.
Well, it would have. This was the local gentry, the local aristocracy, as such, and they couldn't be seen to be, you know, slumming it. A story would be made up, and in this case, it was that the devil had got her, had impregnated her.
Ah, okay.
And you know, the devil was discovered by using as this folklore story of the father playing cards and the card falling off the card table and him seeing the cloven hooves.
There you go.
I mean, you know, it's nonsense. You know it's nonsense. Mm. I know it's nonsense. But however, it then gave the family the excuse that the poor teenager then would be either sent to a home or, and we know what happened here in Ireland to so many of the events of that. But
and is
it
that
did
where,
hide the shame.
Yes. Mm. And is that where the idea of the most haunted house in Ireland comes from, or is it haunted for other reasons?
No, that's primarily the haunted house story. But on the back of that has come sort of this whole concept of curses and people experiencing paranormal events. And, you know, and since the invention of the internet, of course, that's gone worldwide.
Yeah.
And we've had all kinds of paranormal searchers coming here, which, to be honest, you know, as a member of Hook Tourism, I'm delighted.
Yeah.
Let them come.
Yeah. And there was even an exorcism performed there at one stage, wasn't there?
There was, again, in the Victorian era, when the Protestant family moved out and the Catholic family took it over, the Redmonds, who were well known politically in Wexford,
mm-hmm.
the Redmond family of Home Rule fame,
yeah.
Exactly, they initiated, I'm not so sure it was an exorcism as such, but certainly a blessing.
Okay.
A Catholic priest
a
was
better.
Brought in to,
okay.
to carry out a blessing in the property
okay.
Because of this rumour of, you know, Satanism and
Because of the card game thing again.
Yeah.
Because of the card game story. Okay, wow.
It was back to the card game.
Okay.
And the rumours that you're affiliated with, you know, exactly Satanism and so on that
okay.
went with this, the British aristocracy, yeah.
Like when I was a kid, it was like, you know, it was a place that you never even went to. You wouldn't even pass the gates. It has this very imposing kind of scary feature to itself. I don't even know what it is. It has an eerie feel, doesn't it?
It's almost gothic. I think it's out there in the middle of the peninsula. There's the sea on both sides of it. You know, there's this large Victorian mansion, which now looks beautiful. It's the last developer who's currently selling it.
Mm.
You know, spent a fortune with stones craftsmen and people from the North Thames, and teams and teams of people were working on it for a long time. It looks fantastic.
Does it still have that
then,
eerie,
you know,
eerie kind of feel to
it? You know, you often think of some, you know, what's Jamaica Inn, Daphne du Maurier type effect of it.
Yeah,
you know?
Or if Wuthering Heights,
coast there,
if Wuthering Heights wasn't in the, you know, the hills or the
Yorkshire Moors or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it has a funny feel to
that's
it.
That's because it's in that style. It's that mid-Victorian, you know, three-story, as you say, it's that style of house that was so popular as the manor house of the time.
Am I right?
And
I'm thinking there was a nightclub in it at one stage.
Yes, there was. It was a venue, where you could go discoing.
Okay, how bizarre.
After the nuns, not at the same time
after
as the nuns.
After the nuns, good. And was there a movie filmed there as well?
I heard you say that in the intro. I'm not familiar with that now, to be honest with you. There may well have been.
Okay.
It looks like a movie set. I'm not familiar with there being. Perhaps someone more local could back you up on that. I know a colleague of mine, John, his uncle, was drafted in to paint the famous hole in the roof where the devil shot up through, allegedly.
So he's seen
right?
the hole. Okay.
Now, it was a damp stain in the ceiling. But, you know,
don't do that
good
to
story
us
with
now.
The
don't exactly, do that to us.
But however, he was called back in year after year because the stain kept coming back.
Ah, you see.
All right.
Yeah.
And this was the proof that it was the hole that the devil had gone up through with it. They couldn't paint over the stain. It
you
wouldn't
see,
go away.
You see, you're just being a bit cynical there. And that's proven
me.
Wrong.
I don't believe a word of it.
Yeah, I
as
read.
You don't let your cynicism rub off on me.
I did read that a gothic horror had been filmed there in 2017 called The Lodgers. Oh, I remember this. So it's had lots of different uses down through the years. The disco being the best one, I think.
And unfortunately, since COVID, of course, it's been empty.
Yes,
and
which
that's
is very sad to from, see.
It is extremely sad to see. And from the tourism point of view, even the hotel as was planned, which was, I read something yesterday, a 50-bed luxury spa hotel, sort of Monarch-style effect, even that would have brought footfall.
Yes.
And, of course, any tourist area, what we're looking for is footfall. And here in the Hook Peninsula, with 13 beaches, you know, you can come here for a fortnight, go to a different beach every day.
Yes, exactly. We've got
and head to the lighthouse buildings. As well.
Yeah.
Exactly, the lighthouse itself, the oldest operational lighthouse in the world, built at the same time as the original manor house that was built.
Oh,
so
okay.
When Raymond LaGrosse built his manor house, he was building the lighthouse
for
William Marshall.
Good to know.
So that's how old that is. It's 800 years ago. So built between 1201 and 1224, 1225. So almost exactly 800 years ago.
And I'm sure people have memories of before COVID going on the tours there and everything. And they were doing quite well. But as you said, COVID has scuppered it like a lot of places.
Indeed. Did you ever see the marble floor that's in it?
No.
The beautiful mosaic. There's a fantastic mosaic created by two Italian artists who were shipped in. This was in the Victorian era as well.
Yeah.
And the person who was in charge at the time, I'd be loath to mention names, such a lunatic. He felt that it was such a fabulous piece of art. He never wanted these two to be able to do it again. So he had their hands cut off.
Oh, when was this?
This would have been in the mid-19th century.
Wow. Okay, I'm glad I wasn't
in
around
the construction
in that
of
time.
This property, yeah.
And is that a true story? That's not just another piece of folklore.
Yeah, no, that's a true story, yeah.
That's a terrible story to end on, but let's end it there anyway.
Well, the nicer story, I said just to finish up on this current building.
Yeah.
In 1910 in Belfast, there was a staircase built, and it was to be the template for a pair of staircases.
For the and Titanic?
There was one put in the Titanic.
Oh.
One was given to the Vatican City, and the third one is in Loftus Hall.
Wow. Do you know what? I did not know that, but when you started on staircase, I could see the Titanic, the photo of the staircase and the Titanic.
That's it, yeah.
Tell us how people can be some of your visitors and what you do at Hook Tourism.
Well, I'm a guide at the lighthouse.
At the lighthouse, lovely. Okay.
And I'm also a guide in Duncannon Fort.
Great.
So those are our two iconic buildings here on the lighthouse. But Hook Tourism itself is a body that represents all of the people in the peninsula in the tourist industry. So everything from the Irish Experience, where you can kayaking, we've canoeing, we've a sauna down in Bag and Bun, the beautiful Bag and Bun, where you can get coffee on the Clifftop Coffee Shop.
Gorgeous.
So there's lots and lots and lots across Hook Peninsula. Please come and visit us. We're delighted to see you. And not just day trippers. Come for a fortnight. See all the beaches. Bring your camper van. There's lots of them as well.
Chapman's
Norman View camper van as well. So
we'll
get the plugs in. All I can.
He's like a Hook influencer.
And all the Airbnbs across the
Instagram.
Peninsula.
Brilliant, Paul. Thanks a million for talking to me. That is Paul
Ferrick. Welcome.
He is from Hook Tourism, telling us about some of the history behind Loftus Hall. We'd be here all day if we had to hear all the stories, but some great stories there. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Have a lovely
the
Sunday
Grill with Orla Rappel on Beat 102-103.
It's the Sunday Grill. It is Beat. Brian is over there. Say hello.
Hello.
Looking at his phone again.
No, you don't know. You shut up.
So a little bit of action and comedy for you this morning, thanks to the movie Novocaine. It's filled with so-called Nepo babies. I can't wait to tell you about them in a bit. But when the girl of his dreams is kidnapped, Nate, who's played by a man called Jack Quaid, and the clue is in the Quaid, turns his inability to feel pain into an unexpected strength in his fight to get her back. Let's have a listen now. I've watched this trailer and made me a little bit freaked. The whole no pain thing.
I saw her reaction to it, and I can confirm that she did go, ah!
So, what's your deal?
My deal? I'm just a regular guy with a regular job, but I've got this condition where I don't feel pain.
Hey, there we go.
Oh my God, you're a superhero.
No.
Can you feel this?
Definitely feeling something. Last night was amazing.
Oh, get on the ground! Open the vault!
Cops are here early!
We need a hostage.
But no!
Oh my God, what am I doing? I just want to know where Sherry is.
You ever fired a gun before?
Whoa.
so those are definitely third degree, so you're going to want to run it under.
That was the bit that made me go, ooh. Yeah. Now.
I just want to see how you transition. How are you making that noise?
That is called Novocaine, mm-hmm. and it has loads of Nepo babies in it. That's Jack Quaid, who you heard there. He is the only child of Meg Ryan and Dennis Quaid.
Yeah.
And then the love interest is played by an actress called Amber Mid-Thunder. I'm calling her a Nepo baby because her mother is a stunt performer, but also a casting director in the know. And then we have Raymond Nicholson. Do you know whose daddy he is?
Jack Nicholson?
Yeah. Jack Nicholson's son is in this as well, Raymond. And if you like Bad Santa, the comedian Matt Walsh from Bad Santa is in this as
Yeah, he's hangover. And so, and another cast person who, the only other kind of big name that I knew going in was a guy called Jacob Batalon. I don't know how you say his name, but he's Ned in the Spider-Man movies.
Okay.
So he's pretty famous individual. Yeah. But
pretty young cast, wouldn't you say?
Pretty
up and coming kind of.
Pretty young,
well, like 30s. What kind of opening? Here we go. The same trope every week.
It's funny though.
No, it's not actually.
It's funny to me. I don't really care.
Funny to, yeah, that's Brian's, also Brian's trope that he doesn't care. And yet he does. Okay, tell us about Novocaine.
basically, he doesn't care. Really, he does. I really identified with it. No, so it, Novocaine's an interesting story. It's Jack Quaid playing.
It's an interesting concept more than anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Basically, he can't feel pain, like, in any sense. Like, he could, and he does get stabbed and shot and all these things. And he's like, oh, okay, that's not ideal.
Yeah,
like, he'll just be like, oh, I got shot. I better take that bullet out.
Mm.
And I'll just patch that up. And I'm like, okay,
that's also in the trailer.
Time to move on. Yeah. So it's, like, an interesting concept. I've never really, like, it's an interesting way of doing things and the way he kind of uses his body as a, like, same way kind of about like a Wolverine when they know that his body's going to regenerate, like Deadpool type thing.
Uh-huh.
That, like, oh yeah, your body's broken, but you know, it'll you can still grand. Use it as a weapon.
That'll
kind of
be
a,
fine.
Yeah, yeah, and it's in some ways it's done really cool. It's the rest of the movie. I
know,
have
because it seems like it has a really small premise that there's a hostage situation. His love interest is taken hostage. He has to help her.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Honestly, the biggest. Like, it's a fun movie.
Yeah.
So I went to see it with some of the lads from here and we had a fun time at it.
Okay.
Now, did we have a fun time at it because it was funny? In parts, yes. Did we have a fun time at it laughing at it because it was in times bad?
Okay.
Yes. So it's like...
And that's okay.
It was fun. Well, it was bad. And then there's other parts of the story that were so annoying, it spoils the twist itself. Like the twist that's supposed to be this big moment literally is talked about during the movie. Like, continuously.
All right.
To the point where it's like, by the time the twist comes, it's like, yeah, you know, like, it's not even a case of like, oh, I didn't notice. Like, you should know. Like, if you're watching the film at all, you'd know this.
Right.
Like, you know, it's like, what? Like, that's so dumb. So it takes a lot of, like, it takes a lot of sting out of the action because everything that he's fighting for is just not worth it. Which is like, why am I, like, so after the first half an hour is pretty fun.
Okay.
And then after the twist is revealed half an hour early, you're like, okay, well, now this is pointless.
Mm.
Then it catches up to where the twist happens and everyone knows.
Okay.
And then it's a case of, why are they still fighting?
So it's like the classic movie three-act structure, but you know what's going on the whole time.
Yeah. You know the twist going into act three at the start of act two.
Oh, disappointing.
Yeah, it'd be like if you were a bit like...
Are they being a bit tongue-in-cheek about it or something?
I think they thought it was going to be like just a different way of doing it and it's bad.
Yeah.
It's like if they were like Romeo and Juliet and they're like, oh yeah, now if you, sometimes people think they have this poison but they don't die or something like that. And it was like, oh yeah, okay, well now we know that that's definitely going to happen.
That's the twist.
But more so like them being like, oh yeah, Romeo and Juliet are going to die. Mm. Spoilers if you haven't seen Romeo and Juliet.
Okay, yeah.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
But it kind of took this, it took the sting out of it. And also, the love interest part of it is, it's very male gazey.
Okay. You know, don't like that anymore.
No.
And, you know, the kind of, you know, these unique selling points. Oh, he feels no pain.
Yeah, that's
cool. How far
cool.
does that go? That's the cool bit,
well, like,
is it?
That happened, like, throughout the entire, like, so, okay, I'll spit out what happens in the movie.
Don't give the twist away.
I'm not going to give the twist away. It does that itself. So in the start of the movie is Nate is an assistant manager at a bank.
Jack Quaid.
Yeah. And he goes into work, he has a smoothie, he goes into work and this really pretty girl comes in and she's working there.
Okay.
I was like, I mean, instantly, I identify with this.
Yeah.
I also think she is pretty. Like, that's all I had going into it was my friends being like, you'll fancy the main girl. And okay. I was like, I don't know. And I
walked in and I was like, yeah, 1990s chick flick land.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. And then, so he fancies her. Mm-hmm. And then she's basically like, starts going up and starting to talk to him out of nowhere.
Well, I know where this twist is going.
And then she like say, oh, we should go for lunch. And then he reveals to her that like, he doesn't eat food because he's afraid he'll like bite his tongue.
Okay.
And like die and whatever. And then he has cherry pie for the first time and they have a lovely night. And then the following day, a bank robbery happens.
Okay. Yeah.
And then it's the whole thing of she's taken as a hostage.
Okay.
And he's trying to get her back. But
yeah. That's okay.
There's a few questionable moments from police officers throughout the movie that to make the.
And where does Jack's son come in? Raymond Nicholson.
He is one of the bank robbers.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. Do you want to give it some black puddings?
No.
You did this last week too.
Oh, did I? Oh, okay. Yeah. No, it's an old shtick then.
It is an old shtick.
I was sick then. I was a different person. I'm gonna say, look, it was grand. It was like for the parts that like for how much we enjoyed it, I'm gonna say like a 6.
Okay.
But like for how good the movie is, probably like a 5.
When you say you went to a gang from work, how many did you go with?
There was
one.
There was two. There was three of us.
Oh, I'm glad no, but to
like
hear that.
One of the funniest things happened. Like basically, so David, you know David.
I do know David.
David at one stage just went ha ha at one stage from the film, which is like why would you go like that?
I can imagine
it was funny, right? But then like 15 minutes later in the film. One of the characters goes, ha ha. And then we couldn't stop laughing at that. Like, you know? And then anytime something funny happened, one of us would go,
that would
ha-ha.
Be your in joke.
And then we were just laughing for the
That's
rest of the
That's going to be your work thing now that you just constantly say, ha ha.
Oh, we have. We were doing it today. It was actually quite funny.
So, black puddings, please.
I already gave them to you.
You gave me 0.
No, I said 6 for how much we enjoyed it. And then 5.
No. Oh, okay. Okay.
For how based good
All right.
Was.
Another 5 black puddings out of 10. He did the same for Snow White last week, if I remember rightly. And he was kind of slow to give black puddings then. I feel a trend coming on, but don't worry. I'll nip that in the bud.
It's That's Minecraft movie next
era?
Week.
Era? Okay.
Minecraft movie.
Time, not era. Sorry.
I cannot wait.
I'm
very excited.
Oh, so that's why I went to a very popular fast food store and ended up with a Hamburglar from Minecraft.
Yeah, well, I can't wait for this. It's from what I've seen so far, the critics hate it.
Okay.
So you know what that means.
Brian will love it.
Yeah, probably.
In the meantime, 5 black puddings out of 10 for Novocaine. 6 if you go with some friends, but only if those friends are good crack. Thanks a million.
Yeah, that's fair.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rappel on Beat 102-103.